State of Minnesota, respondent versus Eric Umberto Sanchez, appellant. The case number is A230107. And counsel, take your time and get settled in there. I will just remind you that you will each have 15 minutes to present your arguments this morning. Appellant will then have an opportunity for a 5-minute rebuttal. You'll be presenting your arguments in at the lectern this morning, which is adjustable. So feel free to, you know, make sure that it matches your height before you begin your argument if you're comfortable that way. I'll also note, since I don't know that either of you were in the courtroom at the beginning of our session, that our arguments are being broadcast live via the Zoom platform this morning. And we're also making a recording of the arguments. That's just an audio recording. It will be available shortly on our website. And to facilitate the quality of that recording, I ask that you please identify yourself and the party you are representing before you begin presenting your argument. That concludes my remarks. Whenever you're ready, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
So I may need to adjust the lectern here.
There's a button in the sort of middle front, and if you can't find it, our marshal will be happy to help you.
Oh, wow. I suspect that has been true for years, and I've been here and not known that before.
So you will never forget.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Melissa Haley, and I'm representing appellant Eric Sanchez on a criminal conviction out of McLeod County District Court. The jury convicted him of an assault in the second degree, 609.222 subdivision 2, where the elements, in addition to the assault that needed to be proved, was a dangerous weapon and substantial bodily harm. The issues, big picture, the issues that we're raising in appellate's brief relate to due process. On the sufficiency argument, we're arguing that the intersection of the statutory interpretation and the burden of proof, there just was not enough on this record to find that he used a dangerous weapon, which is an element of the offense, and therefore the state didn't have to prove all the elements of the offense, making it not a fair trial for Mr. Sanchez. On the issue of the jury instructions, similarly, we're talking big picture about the dangerous weapon element, and the jury wasn't instructed adequately on all the terms needed to decide whether or not there was a dangerous weapon used in this case. So I'm going to back up a little bit, talk about the instructions issues first, I think. The jury in this case asks questions during deliberations so that we know that they were focused on this element. They talked about, they asked questions about what the dangerous weapon pertained to. They asked a second question about whether the dangerous weapon actually had to cause a substantial bodily harm, which on that second question, we know that under the law, it doesn't. The dangerous weapon and the substantial bodily harm are separate elements. But the fact that the jury was confused and asking about that indicates that they needed more guidance. And there was an objection in the context of that jury question where the defense basically asked for more instruction. And our argument to you is that that objection under, I think it's Kuna, cited in my brief, was broad enough for you to look at the jury instruction issues that we've raised in our brief under a harmless error versus a plain error standard. We are submitting that under either standard, however, there is clearly the lack of instructions on the great bodily harm definition, which is a statutory definition, and the error on including the attempt in the assault element, even though the state and the parties had agreed in their conference that that wasn't, the facts didn't raise an issue of an attempt here.
Counsel, as to the great bodily harm, defense counsel did not object, correct?
Defense counsel did not specifically object when they had the initial conference, and we're talking about that.
Okay. And what would you say to the argument that the testimony there from the doctor and from others would seem to indicate that even if the instruction wasn't given, there was certainly substantial bodily harm, and that they, given his concern, the doctor's testimony of what could have happened, indicates that the weapon was capable of giving great bodily harm, and therefore it wouldn't affect your client's substantial rights. That's the argument.
Yeah, thank you for that question. That's a perfect illustration of kind of the intersection of the interpretation and the sufficiency here. I think when you're looking at the doctor's testimony, and it starts, I think, about page 400, he is talking largely in hypotheticals. He is saying, you know, I've seen baseball bat assaults, and it can cause, I think he talked about significant injury, which is different. And he talked, then the statutory definition here. He also talked generally about when trauma victims come into the ER, these are the steps, these are the protocols that we take. So not specific to this case, not specific to the manner of use, not specific to these particular injuries were consistent with a level of force that we're looking for when you're looking at whether the manner of use was calculated or likely to cause death or great bodily harm. So I think I appreciate that you're focused in on his testimony, because I think that really, that is where our dispute is at, is was there enough evidence there? And that's what the state points to, is his testimony and the victim's testimony. And when you're looking at the victim's testimony, I think on that issue as well, for manner of use, you're looking at what we have from the victim is how the appellant was holding the bat, right? I think interesting about this record is up until the point where somebody gets the bat out, and we need to give some deference to the jury here, so we're going to assume for purpose of the argument today that it was appellant who had that first. Up till that point, they're fairly consistent about what happened, and they both talk about, but the victim, that he was upset, came back to the house with the property, was upset. He had told the other person to get out of the car. The appellant had gotten out of the car, had the items out of the car, and the victim could have left at that point, got out of the car, and says in his testimony, starting, I think, around maybe 200 of the transcript, that the appellant had a baseball bat, that he saw him with the bat, that it had gotten out of the car with it, but that he was holding it down by his side, that he wasn't holding it in an aggressive manner, that he wasn't being aggressive at that point in time. He'd gotten out of the car. The inference from that was the appellant thought he was done. He had his property and was moving on. The victim in his testimony does talk about that he was upset with him when he got out of the car. I think he says not aggressive, but he does say that he was upset and verbally sparring, I suppose, for lack of a better word. And at some point during that, he describes moving around a little bit. The appellant moves from the position at his side, and according to the victim, he's got both hands, so he's moving up. And this is where our position is, you can look at the nature of the injuries as just one of the factors under Basting, right? Vulnerability of victims, nature of injuries, size differential, whether there was provocation from the victim, all of those things are relevant when you're thinking about the manner of the use. So you've got him bringing the bat up like this. His nose is broken. We think about the injuries that the ER doctor described, and it's swelling around the nostrils and the nose broken. No other facial injuries. I'm sorry.
I'm wondering if you could address the Edwards case. That's a 2017 case from this court that is cited by the state. And factually, pretty similar, where you know, the issue was the victim assaulted with a fist or with a knife, and you know, the improper jury instruction was given. And then in analyzing prejudice, the court said, well, you know, we look at the facts, they support the verdict, and here clearly the jury made a choice between, you know, fist or knife, and they chose knife. And I'm just wondering how the circumstances here, for the purpose of the prejudice analysis on the jury instruction, are distinguishable from the Edwards decision.
Yes, thank you for that. So the Edwards decision, the facts of that case, from what we can tell from the opinion, are that the defendant in that case was arguing whether there was a knife or not, an existence of a knife, not whether the object was in its manner of use a dangerous weapon, subjecting the person to increased culpability, but that it was, whether it was there or not. So, and in this case, it's different. Everybody talked about the object, there was testimony, whether it was there or not. I see where you're saying the similarity is that one of the pieces that the defendant was arguing here was that the injuries were caused by fists, but as you're looking as a matter of law, whether the object at issue in this case was a dangerous weapon, you're looking at manner of use, and that didn't appear to be something that was argued or that was central to the Edwards decision.
One distinction that I see is the jury question in this case. And I'm just wondering if you think that's a distinction as well, and if you could address how the jury question, rather, the jury's question specifically about that dangerous weapon instruction, how that might make this case a little different than the Edwards case.
Yes, thank you. That, and I talked a little earlier, but it was a little more general. So the jury question in this case is that they were struggling with the issue that we're talking about, so it's different than the Edwards situation generally. The first question they honed in on was the dangerous weapon use or intended to be used language, and then also the connection between dangerous weapon and substantial bodily harm. And as you think about that, I mean, we're not to speculate on what the jury did or didn't do, but I think what the defense lawyer and what we're the appeal were concerned about is that the jury, the questions kind of indicate that the jury didn't have enough law, what we're concerned about whether this was a dangerous weapon or not, and needed more guidance at that point. So you're looking at outcome, I cited State versus Huber, and as I was re-looking at that, that is more of an analogous situation to this, in that there was a definition or central part of the case of the element missing. In that case, it was intent. It was a second-degree murder case where it was an aiding and abetting, and so the defense was, you know, that I wasn't helping him. That case said, as they were determining that the outcome would have been different by the plain errors, by not giving those instructions, that the jury could have convicted on, you know, could have believed the defendant and still convicted him, right? And this case of the facts, it's a little more attenuated to kind of get to that result. But at the end of the day, the jury was left to decide, did this object, was it used in a manner calculated or likely used or intended to be used, which was the language the jury was focused on as well, to cause death or great bodily harm? The jury didn't have the definition of great. The instructions instructed them to use the common and ordinary meanings. And great is kind of like awesome, and there's a whole lot of everyday meanings that you use that for that can be positive or negative.
But this it's connected court, to death. I mean, and they had a definition of substantial. So even if we conclude it was error, I don't really have a question there, I guess. So finish your thought, and then I'd like you to go back to the objection and which standard of review we are to use. I was fully following you on that one. Sorry, go ahead.
So my thought, and maybe this is helpful with the comment you just made too, is so this court, a three judge panel of this court, considered a situation with a baseball bat and not having the definition of great bodily harm in State versus Bauer in 2019, I think. And in that case, they went through, it was similar, where there wasn't, they were supposed to use the common ordinary meanings. And that court it has very nice analysis about some definitions from the American Heritage Dictionary. Great is larger in kind or amount or remarkable, that type of a thing. And you use that definition with bodily harm, which is any pain, and you get a large amount of pain, just to oversimplify it. And so in this case, the court or the jury could have convicted Mr. Swanson on something much less than what the severity level was required for him. I would argue, again, we talked earlier about the ER doctor's testimony. And the ER doctor did not testify that the injuries in this case or the use of the bat in this case was consistent with a high probability of death, which is if you read the definition of dangerous weapon and great bodily harm together from 609.02, which our position is you do need to, both in the sufficiency and that the jury needed these as well, this evidence just is not there to show that there was a high probability, that he knew was capable or likely, or that there was a high probability of death in this case. And I've noticed I'm out of time. Do you want me to address the objection or
not? You are out of time, and I think it would be very helpful to hear more about that issue in your rebuttal if you wouldn't mind addressing the question
then.
Thank you.
May I proceed, Your Honor?
You may go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Ryan Hench. I'm the McLeod County Attorney. I'm here on behalf of the state and respondent in this matter. May it please the court, Your Honors, opposing counsel. Your Honor, the appellate record in this case includes highly detailed facts. Those facts are critical to the court's analysis of each of the issues raised by the appellant in this matter. In regard to the sufficiency claims in issues 1 and 2, it's important to note that the appellant in their brief spends an awful lot of time setting forth a set of facts that the jury rejected. Not only is this court, under a sufficiency and deference to the jury standard, required to assume that the jury rejected those facts, but it's clear they did upon a review of the record, because the facts were contradictory and entirely at odds. You can't reconcile the victim's testimony in this case with that of the defendant. Their versions of accounts can't be reconciled. To find the defendant guilty, which the jury did on the second degree assault, the jury had to have rejected the defendant's evidence.
Counsel, I agree with you on that. I think there's credibility determinations, but do you acknowledge that it was plain error to instruct on great bodily harm?
No, Your Honor. Your Honor, I believe the facts of the case and the matter in which it's tried is incredibly important. The court reviews, were the instructions appropriate and adequate? If you look at Edwards, which has been discussed briefly today, that court examined the matter in which the case was tried and Edwards came out after Moore, after other cases addressing what's necessary and required as far as sufficient jury instructions. And Edwards didn't find that there was plain error, didn't even go as far as finding that there was any error at all. The holding was if there was error, it didn't affect, it wasn't plain, it didn't affect the appellant's or that defendant's substantial rights. And that's because there was a tacit, there was an implicit agreement that the knife in that case constituted a dangerous weapon. And you can see that in the record here, too. The defendant was zealously represented at trial. There were extensive, thoughtful discussions that are on the record recorded between the district court, between the prosecutor for the state, and the defendant's attorney. There were extensive discussions about jury instructions. There were multiple theories of the defense put forth during the trial. Never once was there an argument that a baseball bat is not a dangerous weapon, cannot be capable of producing death or great bodily harm. It simply wasn't there. So in that context, Your Honor, and with the facts before the court, I don't believe it was error to leave that great bodily harm definition out. Now,
did the instruction conform to the jury instruction, the standard jury instruction?
Yes, I believe the instructions that were provided to the jury in this case largely conformed with the crim jig on the matter. The crim jig, I don't believe, had included the definition for great bodily harm within the dangerous weapon.
And I just want to be clear about the plain error argument that you're making. In looking at the Edwards case, it doesn't look like the court really addressed whether the jury instruction was erroneous. It looks like the court just jumped right to that third element of the plain error test and concluded that there was no prejudice to the defendant's substantial rights. So I just want to be clear about the argument that you're making. When you say there was no plain error, you're saying the jury instruction was totally fine and it doesn't satisfy any of the other elements of the plain error test, or are you sort of using that Edwards analysis?
Well, a little bit of both, Your Honor. I mean, the Edwards court certainly seems to jump to the third prong, which case law says if any of the prongs are missing, you don't have to analyze the other, so I don't think there's anything inappropriate about that. Edwards does allude to the fact of just if there was error at all, so it at least just, I mean, I would like to think that if the Court of Appeals, if the error was so obvious and plain, the prong two, that it would have said as much. And I think what Edwards lends itself to is the proposition that jury instructions matter based on the specific facts of the case and how a case is tried. Now, if the next question is, well, geez, wouldn't it still be better to follow the Bauer analysis and include the great bodily harm instruction? I can't say it would be better or that it'd be worse too. I think it could lend itself to some additional questions in a case where if the theory of the cases of the parties doesn't really focus on that great bodily harm piece, if the weapon itself, if there's really not a dispute about if it's capable of producing great bodily harm or death, is it necessary and will it be helpful? I mean,
well, just to follow up on that question or that point, Mr. Hunch, did anyone in this case argue that a swung bat couldn't cause great bodily harm? Was that argument made to the jury?
Your Honor, the focus, I think the rational inferences that can be drawn from the record in this case is that it'd be capable of producing death. When you look at the victim statements, it was, he tried to kill me, he tried to murder me, he tried to kill me with his bad emotions despite the language barrier to law enforcement. When we get the doctor's testimony, which I think is the most persuasive evidence on this point, it's the doctor did talk about what he normally does in his experience as an emergency room physician, having treated thousands of patients of traumatic injury. But in this case, and he said he usually doesn't get involved till sometime after nurses have seen a patient, done their triaging. In this case, he got involved almost immediately. And the reason he did is because he had learned that this was a purported assault with a bat, and that was the heightened level of concern because of the mechanism of injury and the potential life-threatening injuries it could have caused. I think the treatment shows that. What do they do with the victim? They do a CAT scan of his head to see if there's any brain hemorrhaging injuries to his head. They do a CAT scan of his neck to see if he has a broken neck. They do a CT scan of his abdomen to look for internal damages like a ruptured spleen or injured liver. They do an X-ray of his forearm. Those are to rule out life-threatening injuries. So it was immediately apparent to the doctor, who's in the best position to know, that an assault with a bat can obviously cause life-threatening injuries, or in other words, death.
Well, let's get back to Edwards for a second. In Edwards, the court said nobody argued that a knife cannot cause great bodily harm. Everyone tacitly agreed that a knife can cause great bodily harm. Could you just insert the word bat and make that analysis applicable to this case?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's I think you can. And in this case, that's exactly what happened. When you look at the opening statements, the closing statements, and the evidence they're in, this was a case about credibility. It lends itself to even just the piece about the manner in which the bat was used. That really wasn't at issue in this case. It was, did the defendant or now appellant use that bat in any meaningful way at all? He says he broke the victim's nose by punching him in the nose. The victim testified, which we assume the jury believed, that it was from being struck in the bat, or struck in the face with the bat. That the defendant struck the victim in the face multiple times, repeated more than 10. So in this case, there wasn't any argument about could have the bat been capable of causing that harm, and there really wasn't much argument about how was it precisely used. It was, did the defendant utilize it in any meaningful way at all, and he denied that. So, and when we look at Bauer, which suggests in an unpublished opinion that the great bodily harm definition should have been included, Bauer's distinguishable on the facts. There are some similar facts. There was a bat involved. There were some strikes to the victim. There were injuries to the victim. But there was a dispute about the bat itself. This was referred to throughout that Bauer trial as a small bat. If you review the oral argument, there was questions from the court. Well, was it a souvenir bat? Was it a child's bat? What's this little bat that we're talking about? So the nature of that bat or that weapon itself was at issue. That was part of the record in Bauer, and it was part of the argument. And therefore, it probably did make the specific definition of dangerous weapon more important in that case or at issue. But even in Bauer, even when the Bauer court found that the great bodily harm definition should have been included, the third prong, the court still quickly dismissed of any concerns about whether it affected the defendant's substantial rights based on the way it was used. It was used to hit that victim at least 3 times in the head area. It caused a laceration, the skin to pull apart on the head, and the court found there that the jury surely could have found that because of the way it was used and those injuries, that it was capable of producing death.
What about the jury's question in this case, which suggested that, I don't know what it suggested. I assume it suggested what appellant is arguing that it suggested, and help me with that.
Sure, Your
from
Honor.
Your perspective.
When I view that jury's question, I think it's important to examine it closely and in the context of which it was raised. And the question, at essence, was, when they boiled it down, was did the bat have to cause a substantial bodily harm? That was the narrow question the jury asked. Why did they ask it? Well, from reviewing the record, they asked it because that's what the defendant's counsel argued they had to find. Now, we know that's a misstatement of law. That's not accurate, that the bat needs to actually cause the harm. But that's what the defense argued in its closing, and therefore the jury was struggling with that because that wasn't in accord with the instructions that were provided. What I think that question demonstrates is that the jury was very attentive. They were thorough. They reviewed the instructions. They weren't afraid to ask for clarification when they needed it, and they specifically did not ask for it on the issues before the court today. So, I mean, when you look at that question, that was based, I mean, that flowed directly from the defendant's argument on that point, which isn't consistent with Minnesota law.
So can I turn your attention to the standard of review? And the state's arguing that it's plain error. But we'll hear more about it on rebuttal, but the appellant is arguing that, well, there was some objection to the judge's response to the jury questions, so we should use harmless error.
And thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I believe when the court reviews the record, the record will clearly demonstrate that the court's instructions as it related to the definition of dangerous weapon were never objected to, that the defendant's preference in regard to the jury question was related to the fact of when the underlying definition of assault, which was provided to the jury as part of the assault and second degree instructions. And as the court knows, assault can be proven two ways, harm and fear. Under assault harm, you can prove that by proving the defendant intentionally inflicted bodily harm or attempted to inflict bodily harm. And the court's instruction included both of that entire definition. And that's what the defendant's attorney focused on and wanted that attempted to inflict bodily harm language removed. Now, again, I don't think that's consistent with Minnesota law. And in their brief, appellant tries to suggest that the court improperly instructed the jury there on an attempt crime, as in like 60917. And that's simply not the case. That was an accurate definition of assault. The fact that the defense wanted that to read differently or wanted further clarification on the jury's specific question of did the bat need to cause substantial bodily harm, those are different issues. And I don't think anything the defense counsel, you know, defendant's attorney said there could be properly construed as an objection to the way dangerous weapon was defined and the great bodily harm piece. And I would just, again, note, if this court reviews Bauer and looks at the logic in Bauer of why not include that great bodily harm definition, I do think there would be a danger. The next logical question might be, well, what other definitions might need to be provided? Do we need to talk about what is serious permanent disfigurement? What is permanent or protracted loss or impairment of a function of a bodily member or other serious bodily harm? I mean, how far should we go? If that's not really the issue in the case, would those additional definitions be of assistance, or would it simply serve to confuse the jury? And I think the court here, the district court, was conscientious when it drafted its instructions and provided them. And I believe no error should be found to the extent the court finds great bodily harm definition should have been provided, that error should be deemed not to have affected the defendant's substantial rights. Not here, when the defendant's injuries were so extensive and obvious. Multiple blows from the baseball bat, a fracture to the nose, lacerations, bumps, bruises, tenderness, injury to the forearm where he blocked another blow to the head. On that record, in the context of Davis, Bauer, and any other cases this court could review, there's no way that could equal plain error when the jury surely could have found this capable of producing death. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, I'm going to address the objection issue and then talk about the jury instructions and whether or not the outcome would have been different is my general plan here. So on page 33 of my brief is where we talk about the objected to instructions reviewed, that you may review the issues encompassed by an objection intended to challenge on the elements of the crime if not clearly articulated. That was State versus Conow, and that's sort of a due process. It's you're getting into this relieving the state of their burden to prove the element is where the logic of that case was. I think that somebody asked about the jury instructions.
Well, where was an objection made to the failure to provide great bodily harm? I wasn't clear on that argument either. Are you saying that in objecting to the judge's proposed response to the jury question, the defense attorney pointed it out.
Right. And in that context, the questions, there were two questions. One was a dangerous weapon used or intended to be used. Does that weapon need to be what pertains to number three, substantial bodily harm? And then there was a second, separate question. Does that weapon have to be what caused substantial bodily harm? So, and this is on page 653 of the transcript. As you're deliberating, I hope that you will consider that that first question is what is raising the element of what a dangerous weapon intended or used or intended to be used means.
But do you acknowledge that, I mean, the time to object to a jury instruction is before the jury is instructed?
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, this was a little late in the game.
Okay, fair enough. I'm going to move on from that for now then. I want to talk a little bit about the criminal jury instructions. In this case, 13.10, 11, and 12 are relating to the assault in the second degree with substantial bodily harm and dangerous weapon. 31.10 in the comment cites to both the statutory definitions of dangerous weapon and great bodily harm. We talk about cite Gerbramium in our brief, and that Supreme Court case, they used both definitions and instructed on that. So it was error in this case not to instruct on great bodily harm. On the issue of the outcome, I want to go back to, well, both the Supreme Court case and Edwards and the difference between the two. Edwards, as we talked about, there really nobody was talking about the actual level of injuries, it sounds like, in that case. It was more, was this object used or not? And that is a different calculus than in this case, where perhaps not directly, but it was raised in the context of the attorney talking about the injuries, how they happened, how he used the bat. I also want to correct that respondent said that the defendant did not or denied using the bat, and he didn't. Interestingly, his testimony was that he swung the bat. Now, they disagreed on who had the bat first, but I think there was not a disagreement in this case whether or not he was using a bat or an object. So at the end of the day, what we're asking you to do is reverse for insufficiency, and if you don't reverse for insufficiency, look closely at the record at what he was trying to prove, and how the lack of adequate statutory instruction so that the jury could fairly and thoroughly consider his case was just not a reality for Mr. Sanchez. We're asking you to grant him a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both so much for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to the court, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame.